Hey, Otto.
You had the idea to talk a bit about life, health, lifestyle, and food. And maybe you can tell me what you have in mind.
Well, I've been not eating meat for, I think, 5 years now. And the same with a lot of my friends and family members as well. And yeah, I'm more interested to know in depth what how it affects the body and why more and more people also are choosing to stay away from meat. I mean, it's environmental as well, but I'd like to know more what happens in the body.
I think there's a whole lot more to it. At some point, I decided to eat vegetarian, basically out of necessity. I was living in London, studying in the British Library, and having little money, needing little money, but also realizing that basically I needed to decide between the butcher and the brewer. Because of the restraints on money that I, in fact, opted for. And so I was at some point standing in the butcher and an old lady poking her elbows in my shoulder to get to the counter before me. And a question popped up in my mind, what am I doing here? And the funny part is that in my mind it says something like a connotation of, she seems to be running towards her grave. And I didn't experience that as an opinion of anything, but more as a reflection of something. And it's only later that I discovered that eating meat is the cause of many diseases, principally because in the colon there are residues of meat, which in a way can create a chronic inflammation or a dysfunction of the colon. And as the colon is the place where we take in materials, we do not want to have poisons lingering in the gut. And as it is also the place where we need to get rid of materials, we want to be sure that the gut is actually capable of doing that. A year later, I was at a party and I suddenly realized that I had not been eating meat for a year by then. And I wondered, I asked the people there, I've not been eating meat for a year now, does that make me a vegetarian? And over 6 days, I got six answers from six people having six different levels of what meat is all about. Part of it was about how the animals are treated. Basically, from conception throughout their lives till death, in a very unloving way. And also, that the killing of animals is such a stress that you cannot actually get rid of that, even if you bleed out the blood, which is full of those stress hormones, as is done in some cultures. And by the way, that bleeding only induces more stress in the animals. So I also then learned that meat has the same kind of molecules as we have in our body. And that means that in our body, the digestive system needs to be very careful in deciding what to digest. And this is at the level of the pancreas, and people who have pancreatic problems, that the pepsin production suddenly flares up, they can actually run into the problem that their body starts to digest their own body. So that is the problem which we always have in the digestion of meat, that the edge between us and them is very thin, and that the body needs to be very precise in deciding how to digest the meat. And evidently that is also at the level of the decision between yourself and the other, or you and the world, where the immune system learns from our contact with the environment. How the immune system and the tongue are part of the sensory system by which we can know what goes on around us, and we can learn to interact with that, learn to deal with that, and learn to cope with that, or learn to work with that. So when you're digesting meat, you're in a way putting a claim on a very large position of the immune system. That also works in a psychological sense. I once met an Ayurvedic doctor and also a homeopath, and they were able to see from the way that people looked what their main meat diet was. So essentially, he could see the pork neck or the bull, the cow neck or the chicken neck in the people. So where normally you would say that if you eat carrots, you do not become a carrot, then with meat, there is so much closeness between the one species and the other. And for biology and for medicine, they cannot actually tell the molecules apart. They actually say that it is the same molecule. But that doesn't seem to be the case, because there are many examples of people who had organ transplant, and as a result of the organ transplant actually got characteristics of the donor of that organ. There is a clear example of the dainty old lady who acquired the, I think it was a heart of a sailor, and every now and then she would go into the sailor pubs and start cursing and swearing and singing and smoking a specific brand of cigarettes which the previous owner of the heart used to be smoking. Those stories of course are anecdotal, and they're called anecdotal because they're not published in medical journals. This however was part of a medical research study by a cardiologist who was looking in the effect of organ transplants and also the effect of near-death experiences during operations, surgical operations. So there are many characteristics which we have in the eating of meat, which have to do with the treatment of the animal, the life of the animal, the way the animals are slaughtered, and the way animals, let's say, think, which does not seem to be as separate from us as the meat industry claims. The meat industry actually is the main factor for meat consumption. If you just think back that the Roman Church at some point suggested that people eat fish on Friday, that was not to promote the fish industry, but that was to ensure that people would take in more protein than they were having, because as in India and other cultures, most of the people were having a vegetarian diet. And so it was deemed that it would be helpful if for that large population of that Roman church, people added some protein, animal protein, fish protein to their diet by eating fish on Friday. Of course, there is the strong mythology of the fish in Christianity, and of course there is a idea that eating fish on Friday would mean that on church-going Sunday the effect of the fish might be noticeable. And as people might know, fish and walnuts and other food materials have omega-3 and omega-6 in their substance. And there are many claims that the omega 3 and omega 6 are actually very important in the development of human intelligence and consciousness as we know it. Bernard Gesch, who indicated that criminality is often a consequence of an incomplete diet, did studies in the prisons in England where the youth who came from areas of malnutrition were given omega 3 and omega 6 and some other nutrients while they were in the prison, and they discovered that not only did the say subcriminal or criminal behavior of these people change, but also that it was possible to correct the problems in, let's say, substandard thinking as a result of a lack of nutrients for the brain. Actually, the children in the areas of poverty were malnourished, but that also meant that their brain was malnourished and that they actually could not think in the full sense of the meaning. And then it also meant that their behavior was not complete, as Marty Wuttke, I had to remember his name, Marty Wuttke remarked when he was working with criminals, that there is a digit span which can help characterize the capacity for learning and storing and processing information in memory. So, as Marty Wuttke said, there are studies which show that people with criminal behavior cannot count to 3 or 4. So he said that they see something, they want something, they grasp something, maybe they can run away with it, but they cannot think the fifth step of the consequence that somebody will notice, that somebody else start running to, and somebody else will capture them, and somebody else will put them in prison. So if they cannot step their thoughts further than 2 or 3 steps, then they cannot oversee the consequences. And in fact, there are many people who in that way cannot see the consequences of their own being, and as a result cannot connect to their environment in a healthy manner. So we then have two ideas which are, say, at a conflict. On the one hand, the idea of the Roman Church that people should eat more fish to have more omega fatty acids in their body because that would help their thinking. And on the other hand, there is the meat industry, which then says that the product that they provide, which is actually dead animals because they killed them, they murdered the animals, would provide that substance. That is actually not true. And there it is necessary to make a bifurcation in the road of thinking. And on the one hand, think back of old Egypt, and on the other hand, think back to the coastal cultures around the world. Bernard Gesch proposed the idea that the development of human intelligence mainly originated at the coastal regions, and as a result the thought has been connected to that would have been derived from humans eating fish and getting the omega acids into their system in that way. But on the other hand, if you look at the number of cannabinoid receptors in the body, then you can see that they are all located in the tongue, around the mouth, around the lung ducts, and around the liver, which means that cannabis, which is also a well-known source of rich in omega fatty acids, could actually likewise have been the main staple source or food by which human took in the omega acids. That means that the meat industry, with its claim that people should eat meat, is basically promoting a business, and I'll come to that in a moment. That the Roman Catholic story of let's use fish on Friday might link up to that idea of Bernard Gesch, that it is specifically the coastal cultures which had the higher brain capacity due to the omega fatty acid rich diet or enriched diet. But then as the example of the cannabis receptors, cannabinoid receptors in the body shows, it is as likely that the increase in thinking capacity came not from a non-vegetarian diet, but can well be the consequence of a vegetarian diet. And evidently, if you look at the food substances which are rich in those omega fatty acids, then it's not just cannabis, but all kind of nuts and seeds and other products produced that we can find of earth which can provide that. It means that a vegetarian diet, a vegan diet, can fully cover all those needs. So let me now go to the other road of the bifurcation in thought. The meat industry, and there are two thoughts also which need to be separated out. The one is the industry of meat, and the other is the concept of industry or commerce or corporations. As you may know, and the film, the documentary, The Corporation neatly spells that out. A corporation is actually the new name for a slave plantation. So by law, a corporation is obliged to produce money for the shareholders, say the plantation owners, and it doesn't much matter how they do it. It doesn't much matter what the plantation produces or what the work is that is done. These corporations are mercenaries doing anything for money, and as a result, like mercenaries do, pillaging the rest of the culture for money. That's the reason why corporations get a lot of money. They take it from others and hold on to it, and then by law the cream of the crop of what they harvest goes to the shareholders. So there is a problem with that concept of the corporation as spelled out in that documentary, The Corporation. But the problem there is actually that of money, which is a superstition. It is a symbol of a value, which is separate from the values of people. That's a story in itself, but it's practical to know that in the meat industry, the importance of, as they call it, making money, for them is much more important than that of selling meat, killing animals, and keeping animals in very bad conditions. So if you look at the origin of eating of meat, then it is probably more than coincidental that for the history of corporations and for the history of meat, we can find that all of them, both of them, are connected in ancient Egypt. The plantation or the slave state which existed there had two parts, one in the delta and one in the desert. And essentially, that as John de Mayo described in his book Sahara and Asia, is the area where you see this, the distinction between patrism and matrism. patristic cultures are where the males are dominant, and the matristic cultures are where the females are dominant. As everybody will know, humans are born from a mother, and in most cultures the mother is therefore the pivot of the society and of the family, and also connected to nurturing the babies and nurturing the children and tending the garden and keeping the home, while in such cultures the males are, say, extras. They provide an essential variation to the gene pool, and in a localized community, of course, it is important that the women are able to mate with males who have been able to cross out of the territory in another, because of course if something goes wrong in the survival of that village, you need to have a guy who is able to climb over the mountain and show where there is another safe space that people can live in. So for that reason, for a tribe it is necessary that men from elsewhere come into the tribe and provide their genes to the gene pool, or that men from the tribe have gone to elsewhere and come back with the story of the survival of the elsewhere. Those are even better because they know how to get there and come back again. So that then determines the matristic or female-based society, where the land stands central and where nutrition and sharing of abundance is the essence. And the counterpart of that, and that's clearly seen in Egypt, is the desert tribe. So in the delta tribe, the river floods the delta every year, at least that's how it used to be, as a result of which the silt deposit fertilizes the sand, plants can grow, and basically you can grow anything, and you don't need anything else because the food will be complete. And as it is seen in India, there the vegetarian diet is a combination of grains and pulses and seeds and vegetables. And the vegetables provide the vitamin minerals, and the grains and the pulses in combination provide a complete protein. So in the delta you have that, but when you're in the desert you do not have that. In the desert nothing will grow, and if you live in the desert you cannot plant anything unless you're living in an oasis, which is a little delta. So the only way that people learned to survive that is living by killing. So that is where people living in the desert realized that even though there was not food, there were animals which somehow were able to survive, but they could not find the food of those animals, or they could not eat the food of those animals, so instead they started to eat those animals and discovered that as a result they can't survive. So this is where they have life from death, and that creates a totally different mindset in those desert cultures. And you can actually see that in the religion of ancient Egypt. On the one side you have the god of good, which is associated with the desert, and on the other side you have the god of evil, or the devil, which is associated with the desert. So the good god of the delta, the bad god of the desert, both of them consider them the good god, evidently, because that is the conditions that they live in and have to survive with. So when you look further, then you see that the whole meat industry is then based on that philosophy of the desert, where evidently the male with 15% more muscle than the female were the ones that were able to chase the animals. And there are some interesting movies which you can find on the internet of hunters in Africa, where the hunter basically chases the animal in the savannah, and the only reason that the hunter can catch the animal is because the humans have skin with pores and can sweat and cool down, while the animals with a thicker leather layer of skin heat up too much and at some point cannot run anymore. So the persistent hunter can then catch up with the animal and kill it and eat it and continue living. So the mindset of killing, which you also see in Google and other industries, is where you track the spoor of the other. Google traces the tracks of everybody. As a result of which you know where and when the animal will be at a well to drink, so that you can be more effective, or say more lazy, in the hunting. That was then mainly a male activity, and John DeMeo described patristic societies as very austere, stern. Of course, they're in survival mode all the time. The god of those tribes is, of course, very demanding, as the Bible calls it, the wrathful god. Nothing what you do is good enough. And in contrast, for the Delta tribe, everything you do is excellent. So there is a difference in philosophy, and in the patristic tribes you also see that there is a tendency for genital mutilation. So the circumcision and the clitorectomy come from those tribes, basically as a stunning of the feeling of the people involved. So you could say that in a way they are less feeling tribes, and evidently you can see that in the history of those tribes, that first they were chasing animals, and then they were chasing animals off the cliff, then they used fire to chase the animals into gullies, and then they fenced off the gullies and kept animals in captivity. But all the time they are habituated to killing, and theirs was not only the killing of animals but also the killing of people. And essentially that dichotomy, that difference between the Egypt of the desert and the Egypt of the Delta, is also seen in the story of Cain and Abel, where the story has it that the vegetarian would have clobbered the meat eater, and evidently that is contrary to what you find in culture, that it's the meat eaters who are used to killing, while the vegetarian sees no need for killing at all. But often the winner rewrites history, so that's already an early example of that. But so there you see then that the meat industry actually originates from these patristic tribes from the Delta. For them, the eating of meat is experienced as essential, and for them their way of survival is also to be imposed of others. So at the moment that Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt merged, you can say that actually Cain and Abel had their battle, but the meat eater won, and from that moment on the vegetarian lived in suppression. The meat eaters ran their cattle over the fields of the vegetarians. Of course that leads to conflict, and it took a very long time before the so-called integral farm was created, in which people were able to plant vegetables and to keep animals. And that is essentially the kind of society that we still live in, where there's one part of a meat diet and one part of a vegetarian diet. But as Sri Yukteswar described, when you look at our teeth, you can see that actually our teeth and molars are set to be developed for or by a vegetarian diet, a fruit eater, he calls us. And Fruit eating, of course, is a very nice way of understanding our participation in paradise, because if people are fruit eaters, that means that they are able to find the fruit, eat the fruit, but also gather the seed and plant the seed, so that vegetarians or fruit eaters are able to find the seed, collect the seed, plant the seed in such a way that more and more of those seeds can grow and more of those fruits will be available. So this is in short a bit of the view that I came to, that when we talk about diet, actually we're talking about a very long history of survival of humans on Earth. And the idea now is that humans came from Africa, and there are some people who said that they were actually deposited in Africa from elsewhere, but that they spread out from Africa to elsewhere, and that as a result people learned to adapt to different environments. Essentially, Earth is paradise. Earth feeds all forms of life. And then when people moved away from Africa because of changes of climate, then of course they went into other cultures, and this is something to say about for human ingenuity, that they were able to go into the desert, into the Arctic, into the savanna, into the forests, and that humans essentially learned to live everywhere. And that, of course, would be a very nice experience if people could bring that together and have those solutions available everywhere, but also to be able to choose for the options in which they can actually live off the fruit mainly. And if that is not enough, that they can also live off the fruits and the leaves of the plant, say the salads and the flowers, and mainly the salads, because the flowers of course is the source for the new plant. If that doesn't work, that they can live off the roots of the flowers or the seeds of the flowers as well. Of course you need to be very careful with that, because from that moment on you're reducing the plant source supply instead of enlarging it. And in the desert and other places, people learn to live by killing, but that of course goes at the expense of the life of others. And there are vegetarians who say that they actually made the conscious choice that nobody has to die for them to live. So in part it is a say a biological necessity that people have food, and let's say the good food, so that they can not only survive and live but also think clearly. But on the other hand, that in case that something else is needed, that people are resourceful enough to be able to find replacements. People were able to realize that sleeping under a tree might be helpful. Sleeping in a tree might be better if there are prey animals around. Sleeping in a cave might be even better. And that led to the construction of houses. So humans learn to create the environment which they can live in. But I think it's high time that people learn to create the food environment that they live into. I call that concept planting paradise. That as soon as people realize that in a way they have become addicted to food, perhaps mainly because it is promoted by the meat industry, which actually doesn't care about selling the meat but about making the money, and they don't care about the animals, so then it is a good idea to see what alternative can be found as a source of protein, that no animals need to be killed. And in fact, there are many diseases which come out of the meat diet. I already mentioned that meat often cannot be digested well and leaves a residue in the colon, and results in a toxic slime layer in a colon. And that's also why in Ayurveda they use colonic cleansing to clean out those residues in the colon. And the result is called strings. It is like the whole super skin which has been formed by this coating of debris and residue meat is washed out from the gut as a string. And on the one hand you have the need to get rid of the meat in the diet for health reasons, because there are many meat related diseases, and the best study on that is the China study by Campbell and I forget the name of the other one, two medical doctors who had thousands of researchers doing interviews with millions of people in China and discovering that depending on the way and the type of meat that people ate, they would have cancers and other diseases. So they have a full inventory of the diseases that were caused by meat. And of course, these guys were put out of their job by the meat industry in America. But the result was already there, that at the moment that people add animal protein to their diet, a cancer-promoting molecule kicks in, and at the moment that they stop eating the meat, that is switched off again. So there's good reason not to eat meat for health reasons, but there's also a good reason to stop producing meat for health reasons. Because when I was in medical school, I learned that the annual flu basically had one cause, which was the duck ponds in China. There are two very large duck producing areas in China, and the animals are kept in such miserable conditions that they are weakened, unhealthy, their immune system doesn't work, and microbes and virus are part of their internal climate. It is not just the duck industry which produces the flu, but as Jared Diamond pointed out, the killing of the American native inhabitants in North America was due to the diseases brought in by the Hudson Bay Company and others by handing out blankets to those peoples, to those tribes, but those blankets had been infected with the main contagious diseases that we have in Europe. And it was intriguing for me that I needed to have the story of an anthropologist to learn what medical school did not teach me, which is that the main infectious diseases that we have in the Western culture are associated to the pig, the horse, the goat, the cow, the chicken, and so on. So the chicken pox, the cow measles, all of these diseases are the result of keeping animals in such bad conditions that they are unhealthy. Parasites and microparasites infest them, and that the diseases of the animals then infect the tribes that keep those animals. As a result of the long exposure with those imprisoned animals, the tribes that imprison the animals most often develop immunity, but the tribes that live in a natural manner, such as the native North American tribes, did not have that immunity or immunization. So they were essentially wiped out in North America and South America likewise. So those are just a couple of thoughts about meat and the meat industry, and why on the whole it is unhealthy. On one hand, there is the financial dominance of trying to get rich of the killing of animals, and on the other hand, there is a whole number of diseases which people are so used to that they no longer discern them. So they're endemic. People think that the lifestyle that they have is actually natural or normal, that they get these various diseases. They actually have a whole industry that is now based on combating those diseases, and as it turns out, vaccination, which is from vaca, cow, doesn't really work, because of course the first thing you want to do is get rid of the exposure to the infectious agent, which comes from the animal husbandry, as they call it. So maybe I'll just round it off here and say, well, there's a very good reason to be suspicious of the claim that we need to eat meat. The China study is the clearest example that eating meat is unhealthy. The contagious diseases which are mentioned show the other side of the sick situation of the keeping of animals in imprisonment. And of course, the solution is evident, that if eating meat is not a solution, and if plant protein is the solution, then human ingenuity is, of course, the way to resolve that. If we can replace caves by houses, then we must certainly be able to replace meat by plant protein. And as some shop then presented, it is a meat replacement. No, it is not. Meat is unhealthy, and what we need is a plant-based protein enrichment of our diet. So in that sense, it is good to change the mind, to go to opt for a different mindset and think about food without meat, which means without animals kept in imprisonment, without most of the land on the planet being kept for cattle. If you use that amount of land for planting protein source foods, immediately would get rid of a lot of the greenhouse gases. You could get rid of the sorry state of the animals, and in a way you would essentially go back to a situation which was found in the North Americas, where the land was unkept, plants growed, the cattle could live by itself freely and in balance with nature. So at the moment that the animals are set free and left to live in nature just as all other animals, a new balance will be set up, which will be much healthier for and nature and those animals. But also it will be possible to shift from animal protein to plant protein. And there, of course, there is an immense opening for proposing new ideas. At the moment, there are some agricultural universities which are, say, taking a halfway step to replace cattle protein by insect protein. And of course that has a lot to do with the philosophy that humanity seems to want to get rid of all the insects, forgetting that the insects only come when the health of the plants in nature is disturbed. So when plants are fed on artificial fertilizers, they do not have a complete diet. Their immune system is weakened, and insects can come because basically they are there to clean up the sick plants. And then people say that there is a pest of the insects. No, actually there is a lack of care of the farmer for the earth. As the saying has it, the earth will feed the farmer who feeds the earth. So all of these insects would not be there in that abundance if the plants were healthy. So to shift from an animal meat industry to an insect protein industry would help the ideas in their belief that they don't like insects and they should get rid of them. But as the China study showed, essentially humans are built to use plant protein. So then the question is simply, can we use permaculture in such a way that plant protein will grow abundantly and that we can eat it in the measure as it is available? Because evidently, if you look at the obese Americans, then you see that a change of diet is needed. And if you look at the immense steaks that they're eating in those countries, and the small amounts of protein that are eaten in other cultures, then it is clear that the obesity can be quickly resolved by a change of diet. But the change of diet requires a change of mindset. So then the answer would simply be to get the people from the permaculture philosophy to help people out to understand that you actually can plant nature in such a way that it will produce abundance, that you do not need to work the land, as the biblical notion put it, but that earth will feed humanity by itself, as the other part of the biblical story says, this is paradise. And then people will live in paradise. And that, of course, changes a lot. So maybe this is a good place to round off this story. As you noticed, I needed to go in very many different directions, essentially making a separation between the cultures that believe in eating meat, and actually that is also the culture that believes in waging war and earning money, and the other part of humanity which believes in growing abundance and sharing that with each other, and essentially living a vegetarian vegan diet.